This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here again to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you right now at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, of course, along with our calls, some interesting topics to talk about?
Yes, addicted mice. Mice who get drunk and addicted on cocaine. Let's see what they have to say about our problems, too.
Oh, okay.
Of mice and men.
All right.
And the SALT study, interesting information that came out of Belgium, a Belgium study that will add to the controversy of salt and how salt affects our health.
Always interesting to talk about salt. What's our recipe?
Cucumber bisque. I happen to love cucumbers. I happen to love this recipe. It's a wonderful recipe if cucumbers happen to be one of your favorite veggies.
And this is one from the vault, as our longtime
one from the vault.
Again, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a listener with us now, Zorba in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Well, hello, gentlemen.
How can we help?
Well, my wife and I have an ongoing debate, and we're hoping basically that Zorba...
Well, I can tell you right now, your wife is right.
She does control a few things.
That's right.
Your wife is right.
That's right.
Next
question.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, she basically comes from a family that is sort of very hardy. They're good stock. They live long. They're robust. Their sort of philosophy is not really to see doctors unless they're in need, and basically to just eat well and not worry about vitamins or any sort of supplements. And that's where the debate comes in. I take sort of a generic multivitamin every day, along with glucosamine chondroitin for my knees. And also sometimes I take creatine after I lift weights to sort of build muscle. And my wife thinks this is all three of those, each one individually and in combination, are bad for me because she says something about free radicals and how that me taking those supplements can somehow say either a short-term or a long-term detriment. So I was curious what Zorba thought.
Sure. A couple of things. First of all, free radicals, you know, it's interesting. We think these are sort of cancer-causing agents that are in our body, that sort of come for our body from metabolism. And you're not going to get any free radicals from either the multivitamins you're taking, glucosamine, or creatine.
I always think of the 60s when I hear free radicals.
When there's free radicals. Yeah. No, that was free love and radicals. That was different.
Okay.
Or radical free love. Yeah. Totally different thing.
Right.
Different show time. Same show. But when we look at things, first of all, you know, as you say, your wife's family is robust. And if you eat right, you don't need a multivitamin. But, I've decided I eat right. I mean, I eat pretty right. I don't eat the cardboard diet. I mean, I do eat things that I shouldn't eat. I mean, I was up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and had the best burger I think I've ever had in my life. And let me tell you something. It was oily. I mean, this was not a lean burger at all. But a multivitamin, first of all, cheap, inexpensive. It's got folic acid. It's got B12. And there's good evidence that some people are deficient in folic acid and B12. If they eat right, they're not going to be deficient. But I figured, hey, this is cheap. We're talking about $12 to $15 a year. And, you know, you've made sure you've got that. Now, glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate. The data on that has been getting sort of more, I would say, I don't want to say worse and worse, but we used to think that it really helped. And now the fact is the double-blind placebo-controlled studies, they haven't shown anything. So I tell people, look, if you take it and you feel like it's really helping your pain, by all means, take it. But if you're taking it to prevent something, there's no evidence.
Sure.
You decide there's no evidence, though. So if it helps you with your pain, sure. Does it have side effects? I don't think so. But is it going to prevent anything? No. I don't think there's any evidence for that. And the creatine, kind of the same way some bodybuilders say, hey, I use creatine. It really helps me build muscle mass. Go for it. Doesn't cause any harm at all.
What about the kidneys with creatine?
No, creatine is a byproduct of muscle metabolism, and it's excreted on a very regular basis and a very regulated sort of amount in our body, and so we measure creatine as a measurement of kidney function. But if you take creatine or your bodybuilding, for the most part, you're not going to plug up your kidneys, which is really what they're looking at. It's not really plugging up, but it can overwhelm the kidneys. That's not going to do it. There's certain drugs that can do it. You can do it if you have an injury, an overwhelming injury where a lot of muscle mass actually got destroyed. That can cause kidney failure. But you're not going to get that with the creatine. So on the whole, I come down on your side. I don't think there are side effects from this at all. And yes, they're eating right and they don't want to take a vitamin. Well, that's okay. But I think the multivitamin, to me, I started taking it a few years ago. And do I feel better? Well, I didn't feel bad in the first place.
Right. Well, thank you both.
So. You're welcome. Thanks for your call. And sure. Keep up that exercise and eating right.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
800-462-7413.
You know, it's interesting when we look at these family discussions, you know, with your significant other that you happen to be living with. And quite often, it's really based on whatever the family history is. So if the family history is one of robustness where everyone is healthy and there's not much disease in your family, then you believe that it's the way, you know, your activity. You eat right and you're exercising right and you're doing all of that. And if it's the opposite, you also tend to believe it's activity. And a lot of times these are, of course, genetic issues. And it's nurture and nature that really make a difference.
Yeah. Interesting. 800-462-7413, toll free, of course. And Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin is next. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what's up?
I am calling seeking sort of a second opinion. My husband, for the past couple of years, has been having some pain in his right lower side of his chest, kind of like rib pain. And it only comes and goes every few months, and it's we did see a doctor, and they kind of weren't concerned, but that was probably 6 months ago, and it's still come back a couple times, and it only lasts for about a week when he does have it. So I'm just wondering if Sorba has any ideas.
Yeah, what brings it on?
We were thinking maybe like weightlifting initially, but he hasn't done that in a while.
Uh-huh. Well, if he hasn't done it and the pain comes back, it's probably not for the – is he an active guy? Active? Does he any other activities, exercise at all?
He's a runner.
Does he notice it more after he runs? Does that seem
no.
to be? Because one of the first things you look at when you've got rib pain is what you're doing active-wise, what you're doing passive-wise. In other words, is it something that's happening in bed when you're sleeping because the pillows are awry and sometimes adding extra pillows to the bed can make a difference, or is it an activity? So one of the things I think I would do to experiment is I would run and I would see whether or not I'd keep a diary, and I'd see whether or not when I ran, we'll say 1 mile, 2 miles, 3 miles, 5 miles, you know, does this tend to be an activity that's either related to the amount of exercise or the type of exercise? That's the first thing I'd look at. Weightlifting obviously is not the case since he stopped weightlifting. And then I would look at other activities such as whether or not adding more little pillows to the bed. I'm a big proponent of small little pillows because they can make a big difference in terms of how you sleep at night. They can make a big difference with that. So he saw the doctor, had a chest x-ray, or what sort of a workup did he have?
No, he really didn't have any. The doctor, I guess, just kind of looked at it and told him to take, like, ibuprofen and maybe come back if it kept up. I don't know.
How old is he?
23.
He's not a smoker, correct?
Correct.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. Runners tend not to be smokers, but sometimes sometimes that turns out to be the case. I guess I'm not too concerned about this coming and going, and I would just look and see what activity it is. If it's every few months, I doubt if it's a sleeping type activity. My guess is it's some sort of a exercise activity that he's doing where he's actually stretching and pulling the rib. One of the things that he can do from a preventive point of view is to make sure that he stretches out properly before he actually begins to run. And the other thing would be to look at core exercises, something to build up his core, because this sounds muscular to me.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Thanks.
Thank you for the call. 800-462-7413. What's this little pillow thing? I've never heard you talk about that before.
Travel pillows. You can buy them at Target and CBS Pharmacy, Walgreens Pharmacy, any kind of a department store.
To use instead of your regular pillow?
With regular pillows. And so what you do with people with back pain, shoulder pain, chest pain, you kind of bolster the pillows around you. So you've got lots of little pillows in the bed. And sometimes people can get very comfortable with a bunch of small pillows versus just one pillow for the head.
What do you mean around you?
Well, you kind of, if it's back pain, kind of put it in your back. If you've got hip pain, you put put it underneath your hip seriously.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah.
So what happens, instead of lying flat or lying in one position, prone or in another position on your side, these little pillows can really, really help and make a difference. And they're called travel pillows. I'm not sure why, because probably people use them.
They use them in the plane, I suppose.
In the plane and traveling. Don't you have, you don't have them at home?
No.
Well, since when I injured my back years ago, I got a few of these travel pillows. It makes a huge difference when my back bothers me with my back. And as you know, I have fractured my ankle, and I have these little travel pillows in bed, and they just I can get my ankle into just the right position so I don't have any
pain at all. This wouldn't work for people like me who kind of flail around a little bit.
Well, I flail. I mean, I flail. You know, I mean, I don't engage in calisthenics in the bed, but I flail. I think flailers are often.
Then
you
can put them back in position after when you
wake up. Do you wake up when you flail, or do you just flail?
I don't know, a little every now and then.
Well, maybe when you flail, maybe, you know, Monica puts them back, you know. So, you know, you have to teach her how to put the pillows.
I don't need a little pillow for anything. 1-800-462-7413, and there's a line open now for you. So what's the study with mice and alcohol and what is it? Cocaine?
Cocaine, that's right. That's right. Drunk mice, drunk cocaine crackhead mice. You know, it's a big problem in the mouse population, as you know.
Yeah.
But actually, they were specifically looking at mice and habituating type behavior. And that was the question. And does this help at all?
Well, what was the question? Was the question we're trying to solve with this research?
Well, the question we're trying to solve is whether or not returning back to a certain location will then get you to binge drink again. In other words, if when you go to bar number one, are you going to binge drink because you're going back to bar number one? And if you stop going to that place, is that going to affect your binge drinking or other habitual behavior? Does the place affect the behavior, not you?
Yeah.
So in other words, it's you know, with the same buddies, but you're in a different environment, you may not drink as much. And so what they looked at was adolescent male mice, right? So that kind of fits with, with what we're looking for. And they injected them with
old married mice.
They didn't look at old married mice. They looked at alcoholic. They weren't alcoholics when they began, but adolescent male mice.
Yeah.
And what they looked at were something called conditioned place preference of whether or not mice want to go into one compartment versus another compartment. And what they did was they took the mice, and for 7 days, they basically injected them with 2 grams of alcohol. And that's enough alcohol. That's equivalent to binge drinking for the mouse, okay? That's really what it is. 3 times the limits of what is what are acceptable. And then they were tested for preference of a room, and then they were also injected with cocaine. They basically wanted to see whether or not the cocaine would make a difference.
This is not at the same time.
No, different time. Yeah. And, of course, they had a placebo group where they were just injected saline. And basically what they found was that the hard-drinking mice, in other words, the mice that got drunk, were more likely to be affected by the cocaine than the saline mice. In other words, if you were drinking and you were binge drinking as a mouse and you had cocaine, you were more likely to have preference and want to go back to that location. So that it may be that, at least in mice, a combination of two particular drugs, alcohol and cocaine, were more likely to really set that as a spot you want to go to than if you simply had saline before that.
Yeah. This is, to me, this is so stating.
You think this is junk science?
Look, if a person is an alcoholic and is trying to quit.
Right.
Now, doesn't it make sense that that person would have some sort of kind of yearning to go back to the place where he drinks?
Right. Well, that's exactly what happens. But the problem is, what if the person drinks at home and they're in their house all the time, and so they can't get out of their house and they can't get out of their social environment? What effect does that have? This, doesn't answer that question.
Yeah.
But it also looks and shows that some of the issues are maybe not under really conscious control. They're low-level control. Mice do not have, obviously, the consciousness that we have. And so what we may be dealing with our Pavlovian responses.
Yeah, my guess, smoking would be the same thing.
You tend
to want to smoke in certain situations in certain places.
That's exactly what happens. I quit smoking back in the 70s. Yeah. We're talking about a long time ago. Yeah. Every year when I get out, I have a little 22-year-old Miata. I get it out of the barn. I drive it down the road. It's the end of the winter, and the first thing I want is a cigarette. Now, I haven't smoked since the 70s, but it overwhelms me. I'm in the car driving down the road, and my image is I'm 18. I got a blonde babe at my side. And I'm ready for a cigarette. And when I was 18, all I had was the Marlboros. So you're right, because it becomes an activity where the place then becomes the cue for the habit.
Yeah. Penny has dark hair, is that right?
Yes, I know she does have dark hair. We're not going to go into that. Next question.
800-462-7413. Ann Zorba, listener with us now in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question regarding an ailment which I know has been addressed on previous shows, but that would be restless leg syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking my situation may require a more complex solution, as I've tried both Requip and gabapentin, as well as pretty much a grocery list of other medications.
Mm-hmm. How long have you had this?
Oh, I've had this since I was a young boy, probably around 10 years old.
Oh, my goodness, that's a long time. Can you describe the symptoms?
I can do my best to describe them. I would consider it kind of like, as many would, kind of a creepy, crawly sensation in the back of my calves and the front of my ankles mainly. And it doesn't really present itself till around 9 at night when I'm resting, getting ready for bed.
Uh-huh. So you've had this for a long, long time. Now, you say a laundry list. Requip is a drug that's been approved for restless leg syndrome. It's an anti-Parkinsonian drug that works well for a lot of people with RLS. Gabapentin is a drug which is an anti-seizure drug, which also has been used effectively with this. And when you say a laundry list, do you mean supplements that you've used with that too, or what other things have you used?
Well, I've been working with a neurologist for about the past 6 years, and we've tried a combination of things. Right now I'm on a combination of gabapentin and tramadol, which works about half the time.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Other medicines I've been on is doxepin, clonopin,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
and some low-dose opioids.
Uh-huh.
However, I decided not to use them long term because I prefer to not be on a narcotic.
Right,
so.
And I think that's really a wise decision.
Mm-hmm.
Bedroom, how heavy is your blanket? You know, what sort of what do you?
Well, I use like two blankets. Like, mm-hmm. I have a sheet and then like a comforter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've tried some other complementary medicines, like I guess you'd consider Eastern medicines, like breathing techniques,
mm-hmm.
Yoga, meditation. Which, when I try to focus on that sensation in my leg,
it's an awful
to kind of make it worse.
As you said, creepy, crawly sensation. Have you ever used a blanket? They're little tents. They go over. They keep it so that your legs freely move underneath the blanket. You're not actually – the blanket is not over you, but it's over a little kind of a tent. They're plastic or they're made of metal, and they allow your legs to move freely. Have you ever done that?
No, I've actually never heard of
– I've got a couple of recommendations. First of all, I would get a blanket tent. I think they're actually called blanket cots. But I really – I don't know the exact phrase. But basically, they rent them at health stores. You know, medical supply stores, they'll rent them. They also sell them. And they're usually used for people who have foot ulcers and other problems with their skin to make sure that the blanket and the sheet does not rest directly on the skin of the foot. But sometimes if you allow your feet to move freely, that can make a big difference, because for some people with RLS, they have a combination of things. It's not just RLS, but it's spasm when the blanket actually pushes down on the foot, so you can get spasm then in the calf muscle that then produces sort of an ongoing sensation. It's a feedback loop. And so lighter blankets, lighter sheets work, but for some people it's no sheet or no blanket on their feet at all that can make a big difference. So I would recommend trying that. For other people, from a complementary medication point of view, sometimes high-dose vitamin C, 400 to 800 international units, for some people, can make a difference. In the evening, do you put lotion on your legs, lotion on your feet? Do you massage your feet at all?
I do massage my feet and ankles before I go to sleep.
Because that can make a difference. And the final thing that you may try are something called contrast baths. Now, contrast baths are where you have two buckets of water. One bucket is warm water. One bucket is ice-cold water. You take ice cubes from the freezer and you put it in. And what you do is you spend 3 minutes in the warm water, 1 minute in the cold water, and you do 3 or 4 reps of that. So it's 3 minutes in the warm water, 1 minute in the cold water, and you make the warm water as warm as you can stand it and the cold water as cold as you can tolerate it. And sometimes contrast baths can also work for people who have RLS. So those are some tips. As you can imagine, because RLS the medication doesn't work for everyone, I think I would try these things.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Good luck, and thanks for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Zorba. Bye.
We appreciate the call. Bye-bye. And before the break, Zorba, let's check the Zorba Pasture on Your Health mailbox.
Mailbox? Real mail?
A real mailbox.
Wow.
Well, recently you made the comment about not receiving sympathy cards when you're feeling under the weather.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, we received a get-out-of-jail-free style sympathy greeting card for you from Jeff in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, on behalf of his family. He says, to keep this card, and I'm handing it to you now.
Okay, you're giving me the card.
Keep this card for the next time you feel neglected. It reads, Dr. Zorba, we all hope you bounce back quickly from your recent illness/injury/operation. Pick one.
Oh, that is so sweet.
We enjoy your radio show immensely. Please keep up the good work.
That is so nice. It can be their illness, injury, or operation, or I can do all three. That is so wonderful.
You're all set.
And you know what it says on the front in a little yellow sticker? Even though it's your job to make others feel better, keep this card for the next time you feel neglected.
Exactly. Well, above or under the weather, Zorba's here to help you with your lifestyle questions. Just send them along to us in an email or greeting card to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Well, we have our recipe coming up. Lots more of your calls. Our medical myth buster, too. Our toll-free number, again, is 800-462-7413. Maybe we'll hear from you here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But for our next call, recipe time now, Zorba. And today we're going to highlight a past favorite for another installment of our popular segment, Recipes from the Vault.
From the Vault.
Right. Now, today's revival recipe for cucumber.
Revival. Wait a second. Where do you get revival? Revival recipe? A revival tent? You mean it's like a revival recipe?
No, it's revived from a past time.
Well, it was never dead. I mean, so you didn't revive. Well,
it
I guess you
dead.
Did.
It was
dead.
Yeah,
it was popular. That's right. It's sitting there.
Yeah.
Okay, revival.
Can I go on?
Please.
Today's revival recipe for cucumber bisque is turning 10 this year. So it's from way back of our recipe vault.
Now, wait a second. You think 10 is way back? It's like way back. What about like 20? That's really far back. But we weren't doing this 20 years ago.
Are we ever going to get to this
Please
recipe?
Go on.
Are you going to keep on interrupting?
I'm sorry. Yep.
In any case, Adam had to increase his vault security access to retrieve this one. It was a hit the first time we did it a decade ago, and it stood the test of time. With cucumbers and squash coming into season, it seems appropriate to highlight it once again. So, without further ado or interruption, an encore of cucumber bisque.
That's right. Actually, I do remember this recipe. It happens to be one of my favorite recipes, and we had a ton of people who wanted this particular recipe. Mm-hmm. And that's probably because when we actually did it, there was a ton of cucumbers. And, like zucchini, people weren't sure what to do about it. But it's really good. This is a really refreshing summer recipe, spring summer recipe. Start out with 4 large cucumbers, peeled, seeded, and chopped.
4 large cucumbers, peeled, seeded, and chopped.
So now when you seed your cucumbers, how do you do it? Do you cut it lengthwise and then kind of put your finger in there or use a spoon? How do you seed your cucumbers?
Both of those would work
would work, okay. Yeah. 1 small summer squash chopped.
A small summer squash chopped.
That's right. I'm not going to ask you anything about the summer squash. You're smiling. There's nothing to ask about.
Yeah.
Four green onions sliced.
Four green onions sliced.
Okay. A cup of northern white beans drained.
A cup of northern white beans drained.
That's right. It means you get them from a can, Tom. They're drained.
Yeah.
Now, do you know, is there a difference between northern white beans and great northern white beans?
I have no idea. I assume that the one are a little bit larger than the other.
Yeah, I think great might be. Or maybe just, you know, maybe, yeah, I think someone would be a little bit larger. The great ones would be okay, too.
Yeah.
Now, 3 cups of low-fat chicken broth. You can also use 3 cups of veggie broth if you would like.
Okay, 3 cups low-fat chicken broth or veggie.
Or veggie broth. 2 tablespoonfuls of fresh chives chopped.
2 big tea fresh chives chopped.
That's right. 1 cup of plain yogurt. It's not vanilla yogurt. It's not sweetened yogurt. We're talking plain yogurt. And you could use plain Greek yogurt also, which would add a nice tang to this.
Okay, 1 cup of plain yogurt.
That's right. You're going to use salt and pepper for taste. And if you can, 2 tablespoonfuls of dill leaves chopped. If you don't have any dill leaves, it's okay. But you might have some dill weed that's dry that you can also use instead.
Are dill leaves hard to come by?
Well, it depends on the season. Sometimes they're there. Sometimes they're not. Depends on your grocery store. And cost. It's more expensive in the wintertime.
They don't fly them up from Ecuador.
Ecuador. Ecuadorian dill leaves. Okay. Yeah. In a large saucepan, combine the cucumber, squash, onion, beans, chicken broth or veggie broth, and chives. Cover and cook until it's kind of a gentle bubble for about 20 minutes or until the cucumbers are nice and tender.
Mm-hmm.
Then pour it into a blender or food processor. I use a blender for this because it's easier. Whirl until smooth. Transfer to a large bowl. Blend in the salt and pepper to taste, and the yogurt. You're going to just taste and see how much you need. Cover and refrigerate thoroughly until chilled, and then sprinkle the top with a little bit of chopped dill just over the top of it and serve it cold, and it's really, really good.
What do you serve
this with? It's very refreshing. What would I serve it with? What would I serve it with? The first thing that comes is something from the grill. So maybe I might serve it with a boneless skinless chicken breast that I might put. I love salmon on the grill. This would be great with salmon. I've got a dynamite recipe for teriyaki salmon that I really love. I might even serve it with a brat if I were in the mood. But that's basically – it's wonderful. It's a very low-caloric recipe, 115 calories a serving. You don't get lower than that.
Mm-hmm.
It's got dietary fiber, nearly 20% of the dietary fiber that you need for the whole day. And, of course, it's low in sodium, and it even has a little bit of protein from the yogurt.
It does sound good. And if there's a recipe you forgot to jot down or just feel needs a second run in the spotlight, let us know about it, and it might just end up being our next recipe from the vault. Simply send the name of the recipe and an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org, or you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help out a listener now in Smithfield, Utah. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. Love the show. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much. How can we help?
So I have a question regarding vaccinations, and specifically, I want to ask about the DTaP, which is the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a two-part question. The first part is, if I gave my child the vaccination today, would he be immunized today? And also, how long does the vaccination last?
Well, first of all, he would not be immunized today. You have to have a complete series for the vaccination, and it all depends on where his age is. But, generally for DTaP, the series, I believe, is 3. I'd have to look at it. I always look at the chart because they change all the time. But it depends on where you are, whether or not it's going to be 3 or 4 injections. But for full vaccination, I think for DTaP is 3. I don't think it's 2, but I think it's 3. Once again, you have to look at the age, and then you just look on a chart.
Over what period of time?
Well, it all depends. it may be you know, one and then one 2 months later and then one 6 months after that. Again, it's the federal government looks at it, looks at how to get immunization for pertussis and, of course, for tetanus and then determines what that is. And so without the package insert and looking at the chart, I don't want to quote exactly what it is with the child. But it's a cookbook thing. In other words, you follow this and you basically get the vaccine over this period of time. How long does it last? Well, it doesn't last forever. And that's why we get boosters. And one of the issues with pertussis is it doesn't last forever in adults. And we're beginning to discover that more and more often. And so the federal guidelines changed a number of years ago where when we boost people for tetanus, we are now also boosting them for pertussis because we know that pertussis can also affect adults. It's a big problem in children, but pertussis has been a major issue. It was also a major issue because for a while people worried that autism was caused by the pertussis vaccine. And it was a different type of a pertussis vaccine that we used years ago that caused a high fever and problems. But I think that the vaccine autism link has really been discredited. I mean, I look at the data. I've looked at the science. I think there's good science that autism is not related to pertussis vaccine or to measles vaccine for that matter. How old is your child?
He's one right now.
He's one. And you never vaccinated him at all?
I haven't yet.
Uh-huh. So you've been, why are you thinking about it now? What's motivating you now?
There was an outbreak in our community,
right.
And I'm not totally worried about it, but I was just more curious. My interest kind of peaked about it and thought I should investigate a little bit more.
So outbreak, there was a big outbreak because, and this happens in certain areas of the country, a lot of kids got it or there were serious cases for it?
No, about 3 or 4 kids got it. And it just went around. My children are homeschooled, but I did hear on the radio that they were keeping some of the kids out of school who were not vaccinated. And so I just thought I'd look into it.
Oh, sure. You know, it's once again, you know, if kids are in school, they're going to who are not homeschooled, they're going to come into contact with many more kids, you know, and they're more likely to get it. I think you as a parent have to look at your child and decide what you think is best for them. And I think ultimately that's why, you know, we have guidelines and they're not rules, they're guidelines. So, but I think looking at the data as a parent periodically and then making a decision is also good, you know, sort of giving it a fresh look every 6 months or once a year and say, well, do I want to vaccinate my child now? What are the risks of vaccine on one side and what are the benefits on the other side?
Great. Well, thank you for answering my questions.
You're most welcome and thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And before we close out our recipe segment, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pasture on Your Health inbox and see if we can help out Amy from Monona, Wisconsin. She writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I'm trying to avoid eating foods with added sugar. When reading labels at the grocery store, I often see an ingredient called evaporated cane juice listed on various items, including almond milk, yogurt, and canned tomatoes. I think this is just a fancy name for sugar and that our bodies will treat evaporated cane juice the same way they handle fructose or sucrose. Am I right?
You bet your life. You are absolutely right, you know, because we now know, you know, high fructose corn syrup is, you know, getting a bad name.
Yeah.
And it may indeed be different. All sugar is sugar in its calories, and they might be metabolized a little bit differently. But evaporated cane juice sounds a lot better than high fructose corn syrup or sugar. But in fact, it's going to produce the same amount of calories on a gram-for-gram basis. So you are correct.
Aren't they regulating that? Didn't I hear you talk? I think,
you know, as much as they
evaporated cane juice.
As much as they regulate it, we give it different names. That's exactly it. Before you know it, it'll be evaporated organic cane juice. And that'll make it even better.
Well, you sweeten up your day by getting answers to your lifestyle questions. Just send them to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have an interesting piece of research coming up for you. More of your calls as well. And don't forget our medical myth buster. Right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But before we take our next call, Zorba, seems interesting to me, more research on salt, which may kind of throw some turmoil into this salt question.
Oh, there's been turmoil going on with salt for years. And this particular article published in the Journal of the AMA is sort of gets a contradictory conclusion to what we're looking at in terms of reducing salt in the American diet. Now, in this particular study, let's look at it. 3,600 men and women. This is a European study, Belgium, Bulgaria, Italy, mm-hmm. Poland, Romania, Russia. Their health was followed for 8 years. They were young. They were definitely on the young side, no doubt about it. 49 was the average age at the study's end. They looked at their sodium intake. And what they did was they also looked at how much sodium they were actually excreting. Now, sodium excretion is kind of a good measurement of how much sodium you're actually taking in, because if you take in more salt, you excrete more salt.
Okay.
And lo and behold, the participants were 56% more likely to die of cardiovascular disease if they had the lowest sodium excretion, meaning that they had the lowest sodium intake.
So according to the study, less salt could be more harmful.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Now, we have to look at a few other things here. First of all, these are young people. These are people under the age of 50 mm-hmm. who are not likely to get heart disease. The ones who are likely to have heart disease and die of heart attacks are clearly over the age of 50 and 60 and 70. It was a rather short duration. There were only 3,600 people. Well, that's a lot.
That's a lot of people.
But to really power a study like this, you probably have to have about 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. But I think it, once again, looks at salt and where salt is an issue, and it's something I've been talking about really for a long time. Some people appear to be salt sensitive and some people appear to be not as salt sensitive. And there is too much salt in our diet. We should reduce it. But mm-hmm. how far do we have to go? That's kind of the question.
Well, now I know the Harvard Medical School issued a critique of this study.
Oh, absolutely.
And thought it to be faulty.
Yeah, they said it willy-nilly. And they said, well, they didn't use the word phony because they're from Harvard. So they said they didn't think the study was very good.
Yeah.
And they said, well, if you're worried, you know, reduce your other cardiac risk factors and try to work on that. But I think this just shows that sometimes we do go overboard. For instance, in a major study of diabetes called the ACCORD study, we found that blood sugar that was too low really wasn't good for you, that if it was way too low, that a blood sugar that was reasonably low was actually very good for a diabetic. And I think this study maybe shows the fact that we ought to reduce salt in our diet, but we don't have to go overboard. And you should find out if you're salt sensitive. And the reality is, the way you find out is reduce salt in your diet, see how it affects your blood pressure. If it goes down, then reduce it a bit. If it doesn't go down, well, maybe you're not the one who has to reduce their salt significantly.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413, and we have a line open now for you at 1-800-462-7413. A caller now, Zorba, in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, about 5 months ago, I started getting sick with fevers that, would range anywhere from 101.5 to 102.5, and basically, on average, a lot the first month, and then basically about one a month the last two. You know, it's kind of becoming difficult with having to miss work because I'm too sick to go in.
Oh, well, have you seen a doc about this?
I have.
And he or she said?
They're still looking. They ran a bunch of blood work last week, and the only thing that was confirmed is that I'm anemic.
Right. How old are you?
I'm 45.
45. And how anemic were you?
I had two tests. Mm-hmm. First one, they said borderline, and the next one, they just said anemic. I can give you the test results.
Well, but borderline and anemic, a blood test can vary by about 0.5 based on the machine and some other factors in there. A 101.5 to 102.5 is a significant fever. That's not an insignificant fever.
Yeah, for an adult,
You bet. And the thing about it is you have to find out what's causing the fever. In other words, I think if the fever happens – I just want to go back. The fever is happening how many times a week?
No, not a week. It's every few weeks.
So it's every few weeks, lasts for a day or 2 days or 3 days or?
2 days to just about a week, when it was actually the lowest.
When it was the lowest.
The lowest one lasted longer.
Traveling to foreign countries recently at all? Come into contact with people with an infectious disease such as tuberculosis? Anything of that nature?
No.
Well, first of all, this is called a fever of unknown origin. We've got a name for it, FUO. And sometimes they're very, very difficult to tease out. And there are a whole list of things. If you look it up in something called PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, there are a whole list of things that can cause a fever of unknown origin. Things that are serious, such as a lymphoma or an undiagnosed cancer. Things that are mild, such as a prolonged viral disease or recurrent viral diseases that you get infected with. And the main thing is, if they continue to happen, you have to make sure you have a diagnosis. There's some inflammatory process that's going on in your body that's actually causing it. And continuing to run the blood tests, I think, are really critical issues. And sometimes it takes a while for the disease to declare itself. In other words, you may not discover the answer now, but in a month or in 2 months, you may discover the answer, and all of a sudden, you know, the disease rears its head, and you go, yes, this is the problem that's there. But I don't have an answer for you, but my answer would be, you can't stop until you find out what causes this. Now, are you taking your temperature every day?
I haven't for a while.
Mm-hmm. I think you ought to take it every day in the morning. I think before you get out of bed, before you have anything, before you brush your teeth or anything else, take your temperature every single day before you get up. You want to have that temperature. You want to have a chart of your temperature so that you know what that is. I think that's a critical aspect for somebody who has a fever of unknown origin. And if you don't feel well in the afternoon, you take your temperature in the afternoon. It'll give even more data. In other words, if you go, hey, I don't feel that good, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, take your temperature and see what your temperature is. Write it down, bring it into your doc. Critically important, I think.
When it comes to thermometers now, are those temporal or anyway, the forehead scan ones? Any good?
I don't think I would use a forehead scan thermometer. I would use, you know, one of the disposable thermometers or one of the electric ones that go under your tongue. They're much more accurate. They're much more likely to pick up your temperature. I would not use a forehead thermometer. It's not going to give you good data. And of course, mercury thermometers are a thing of the past.
Yeah.
Take care. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Zorba time once again now for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with the medicine cabinet. Seeing as how medicine is right there in the name, it's long been thought that it's the best place to store your vitamins and medicine. Well, new research is showing that may not be the case. So is the medicine cabinet the best place to store vitamins and medicine?
Well, I have to tell you, I have thought that the medicine cabinet is the best place to store your vitamins and your medicines, but the research looks at the humidity in the bathroom. And the humidity in the bathroom is higher than in the rest of the house. It's often hotter than in the rest of the house because you've got a shower going, you know, or you've got hot water that's going. And when you open up the bottle, you introduce more moisture into the bottle. So airtight bottles are airtight, but when you open them up and take out that vitamin, it may not be as airtight. So it might be a better place to store. It might be a place that's outside of the bathroom. But here you have other problems. Where are you going to store it in the house to make sure that it's safe, that kids can't get to it, it's in a safe environment? You know, you have other problems when you move it outside of the medicine cabinet.
I can tell you what we do.
Oh, tell us, please. Where do you store it?
Bread box on the kitchen counter.
Bread box? Where do you store your bread?
What bread?
So that's it. We'll take Tom's advice. It's the bread box on the kitchen counter.
But to answer that, we do have bread, and we put it in the fridge.
Right. And that may be the answer. I think looking at this really is important, especially for a vitamin bottle that you may have for a year. When I buy my vitamins, I buy them in, you know, 150 or 300 tablet containers. And so they're there for a year. And they often have that little desiccator in there that's supposed to keep it dry, that little sort of white little pellet in there.
Right.
But they only keep it dry for so long.
Are you supposed to leave that in there when you're taking your stuff?
Because it keeps it dry. What do you do with it?
I throw it away.
No, it's supposed to stay in there. That's the reason that it's in there.
I thought it was just in there while it was on the shelf.
No, it's sealed while it's on there. Well, it's for both. You should leave it in there. Yeah. Don't swallow it, Tom. It's not to be swallowed.
It gets in the way. Well, we've just installed a myth cabinet in our studio, so send in your myth, and we'll try not to store it for too long. Just send your myth in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413, and Zorba, a listener with us now in Grove, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
I am calling about food allergies. I have an allergy that I've never had before. I'm 25, and last summer I had some blood drawn to test for some food allergies. And I found out I was allergic to many things, but pineapple being my number one allergy food allergen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what are you concerned about? What sort of, when you say you found out you were allergic, you ate the pineapple and broke out in hives, or you had a blood test, or how did
No,
you?
No, okay. So I have ate pineapple on and off my whole life and have never had a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Last spring, I went to the produce section of my store, and I ate for about 2 weeks straight a tub of pineapple a day. Just wanted it. It was great. Ate it. And I thought that my allergies were just really bad, but I developed blisters on my eye, on my conjunctiva, my sclera, my lids, really bad, and I couldn't see the book in front of me.
Wow.
And I didn't know at the time that I was allergic to pineapple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had some rounds of steroids, and it was getting to the point where I couldn't have any more.
So let me get this straight. You're eating the pineapple, and you're taking the steroids.
I guess you're right. I kept eating the pineapple, but I didn't know that it was from pineapple yet. So I'm still oblivious to this.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, my physician referred me on to an ENT, who tested me for environmental and food allergens. And on my blood results, my number one food allergen is pineapple. And I want to know how, why 25 years later am I just finding out that I'm having reactions to pineapple when I've never noticed it before?
Well, first of all, let's look at the blood test. The blood test is not completely predictive of whether or not you're going to get an allergic response to pineapple. In other words, let's put that to the side.
Yeah.
Clearly, you love pineapple. If you're eating a tub a day of pineapple, you like pineapple.
But you did have the
allergic response. I understand, but it may be a dose-related issue. So I don't think you should necessarily give up all your pineapple. I think you could reintroduce pineapple and see if the same thing occurs, but in a smaller amount. It may be that a tub of pineapple you don't tolerate, every single day, but maybe you can tolerate half a tub of pineapple or a quarter of a tub of pineapple. So the tests do not really show they're not 100% conclusive. What's conclusive is you take the food and whether or not it occurs, and it may be a dose related amount or it may be specific for that. And getting back to that first question, we can be fine and never develop an allergy, and then 20 years later, one day we develop an allergy. Why does that happen? I don't think there's really a good answer. But one day allergies develop. It happens with medications. People will be on a medicine and all of a sudden they become allergic to it, and they may have been on it on and off for years. Antibiotics are a perfect example. They may have gotten amoxicillin or penicillin on and off for 20 or 30 years, and one day they break out in a hive. Why? I don't think we really know the answer to that. But getting back to food, don't trust the test. Trust your body. And so the good news for you is you can go back to eating pineapple and you can do your own experiment and see what's going to happen. You're not going to do yourself any harm. The bad news is it can't be a tub a day.
Okay, good.
Have I made your life better?
Yes. Well, I guess because the four allergens that I'm allergic to, not just sensitive, was pineapple, chocolate, cow's milk, and strawberries.
Yeah, change doctors. That's exactly what I would do. It's like you can't have strawberries, you can't have chocolate. The blood tests, which for many people are called a RAST test, R-A-S-T, are not that predictive of the actual allergy. So what you do is you reintroduce the foods, see what happens, and that's how you judge it.
Okay.
Now, there, I do want to make a caveat. If you had broken out in hives, if your eyes had swollen, if you had become short of breath, like we'll see with peanut allergies, like we'll see with fish allergies, mm-hmm. if it's a serious allergic reaction, that's a different issue. It sounds to me like what you're having is much more of a mild reaction, and it's more in the realm of an intolerance than a true allergy.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good luck. Enjoy your chocolate, your strawberries, your pineapple, and what was the last thing?
Cow's milk.
And cow's milk. Right. That's right.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Why am I hungry for pineapple all of a sudden?
You know something? I am hungry for pineapple too.
Before we clock out, Zorba, it's time for another installment now of Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's dissent comes to us from Anna Marie in South Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who takes issue with your constant dressing down of smelt. Anna Marie writes, I listen to your show regularly, and I'm a big fan. It is for this reason that I let the first offenses slide. In the recent past, however, I have heard you make at least three disparaging remarks about smelt. I am a lifelong resident of the Milwaukee area. The little fish that we harvest from Lake Michigan are actually called schmelt. S-H-M-E-L-T,
smelt.
Or is it schmelt, S-C-H-M-E-L-T? This may be because there are so many Schmids, Schmitz, and Schumachers in the phone book. Next, she says, I would like to address your mother. What could she possibly have done to a schmelt to make it taste so awful? I'll tell you what my mother did. She fried them in oil. Heart smart, maybe not, but oh so yummy. Do yourself a favor, Zorba, and get yourself to a schmelt fry soon.
I can smell it now.
If you have a schmelt to pick with Zorba, let us know during the next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or find us on Facebook.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Friedrich is our executive producer and the ace of our production rotation. Technical director Brad Kohlberg provides some middle relief. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, on the bench and ready for you next time here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0519Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.